Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
It's official. I love my new introduction. Thank you, Jack, for designing that. My name is Patrick Martins. You're listening to the first show of the week on the Heritage Radio Network, The Main Course. I'm your host, and we are engineered and produced in studio by Joe Galarraga. Joe!
Hello.
Hey, how's it going in there?
It's going quite well. It's nice and cozy in this cold fall day.
Nice.
I'm loving it.
Good, good. Yeah, you sound very enthusiastic.
Thank you.
I am very excited. This is a first. I can't believe it's taken this long, but I'm very excited about today's show. I'm very excited about this week in the history of Heritage Radio Network. It's appropriate that we start this week off with our guests. In a couple minutes, we're going to bring in three of the top, the triangle of charcuterie in America, some would argue. It is a very, very interesting place, the fatted calf. We have Taylor Boddicker in studio. We have Toponia Miller in studio. And we have Simply Bailey, the one named Bailey. So welcome, guys. We're also going to have Scott Boggs come in from the April Bloomfield Empire. He does different things. I think right now he's working at Salvation Tacos, a good friend of these guys. He's going to come in and ask some questions with us. But I am really excited about this week, Joe, as I know you are, because Heritage Radio Network is adding a major new component to the homepage and to our kind of daily life, and it is a news section, and it's divided into six categories, Joe, if I remember correctly. Pleasure is one. Science and technology is another category. Opinion. We have people doing opinion pieces. We have a health section. We also have, which one am I forgetting?
Business.
Business, yes. We have a business section. So, you know, those categories will sound super familiar to people. And in each of those categories are going to be, you know, mostly 3 to 5 minute, but it could also be 90-second stories. Could even be 7 to 10 minutes if it's a super important story. Done by our in-house crew. It's a hodgepodge group of interns and people who've been in the business for many, many decades, who are all kind of rallying around this idea of making fun, interesting, educational stories about food and all of its facets. So, Joe, I know you've been in studio for some of the listening sessions. They have they covered the storm in North Dakota, you know, and
that was a great piece.
Yeah, it's a great piece and a huge story. I'm surprised more food sections don't cover that story. We talked about 3D printing. Dave Arnold did a piece on printing your food and, you know, how absurd that is. We learned about heat and how heat works in one of the stories. Costa Rica, we're doing a series on the food and the sustainability there. And finally, another story I remember, the founder of the gummy bear passed away, very sadly. It was very funny. They were reading his biography. Joe, I think you were there, and they were like, this is a German man who made this, you know? And you're like, and he rose to prominence until 1939. Then when the Americans invaded, he was in a prisoner of war camp for 8 years. I was like, that guy sounded a little...
A little dodgy,
yeah. But he did nonetheless start the
engine.
Yeah. Anyway, so I'm very excited, and I really do think, and this I talk so much about this, a million miles a minute, but I really do think that HRN is now going to be a website that people are going to want to visit once a day, every day, just to browse the news stories. There should be 3 to 4 to 5 news stories a day. So it's going to be really, really interesting. And, of course, everything else will remain the same. The shows will be the same. The archive, you can still search for things, topics that you're looking for. But I'm really excited about the fantastic job that this news team has done over these past few weeks. I think when they open the site, there's going to be about 45 stories just to start things off on. So very, very exciting. It's a huge week for us because of that. And we are starting the week with a huge show. So we're going to take a very big break, a very short break, sorry, and come back with Taylor, Toponia, and Bailey from the Fatted Calf in California. Stay tuned.
With that is great Middle Eastern restaurant out here as well, where that was even Japanese, you know, that was a huge influence.
This is my band. It's called Big Ups. You're listening to The Main Course on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I need to treasure every minute. The fact that I'm here and I'm living within it. Sometimes I feel like the pace of my life's too fast, and I think about the time that's passed. I can't remember what happened yesterday, the day before, or anything, at any rate, anyway. I think what I'm trying to say is, I don't want to live a life like this. What happened to all those black and I'm blind, they're dying, and I'm trying to think back. And I can't seem to conjure up anything, and the fear consumes me as they start to lose me. What happened when it all goes black and I'm blind, they're dying, and I'm trying to think back. And I can't seem to conjure up anything, no, because I haven't done anything. I feel like I've led a pretty happy life.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
I am so attracted to you right now, Joe. I can't even begin. I can't even focus on the interview. That was you?
Yeah.
You're so good. Yeah.
Well, let's just know the feeling's mutual.
Thank you. Well, listen, I know that's why you applied for the job in the first place. We were like, there's no pay. You're like, I still want to do it.
I was drooling. So the opportunity.
That is very impressive. And thanks to Sam Edwards for sponsoring us. I am very happy to have Taylor, Toponia, and Bailey in studio. Fatted Calf is really one of the most important charcutier companies in the country. They probably do more different kinds of charcuterie than anybody consistently. You know, everyone does one or two. They're consistently banging out like 80 to 100, maybe even more. We'll talk to them and find out exactly how many. But it's very impressive. It's very consistent. And it is like a real explosion of energy that comes out of a place, you know, and it's very, very interesting. Most people don't know them because primarily they sell within the state of California. But we have them in studio because they are on a book tour for a book called In the Charcuterie, published by
10 Speed
Press.
Yeah, 10 Speed Press.
It's a big, beautiful coffee table book, just to show how legitimate it is, just for our listeners. Here, I'm going to drop it on the floor right now. That's a legitimate book.
That's 352 pages smacking you in the ass.
Yes, it is. So just for our listeners who don't know, who haven't been to Northern California, I ask this to all three of you. Who are you, and what does the Fatted Calf do?
Who wants to take that one? You want me to take it? All right. we are a small artisanal charcuterie that is 10 miles wide and an inch deep. We make, about 80 to 100 different products on a weekly basis. Everything from beef jerky to about 4 to 6 different kinds of terrines. We do bacon, hams, about 40 different kinds of fresh sausage, all in really small batches so we can turn it over, keep it really fresh, really awesome. And we use the best ingredients we can find, and we do it with gusto and with amor. So that's in a nutshell who we are and what we do.
And where are you, and where do people find you, and tell us about your locations.
We started the business in San Francisco, and then back in 2003, and then we moved up to Napa to open a store there in 2008 to be part of the Oxbow Public Market, and then we opened our San Francisco store, kind of getting back to the city, in 2010, a little over 3 years ago.
And what percentage of your business is farmer markets? Because I know in Northern California, those are big, beautiful centers of the whole community.
Absolutely.
There.
We're lucky enough to be a part of one of the best farmers markets in the country, the Ferry Plaza. We're there every Saturday from 9 till 2, I think. And I'd say it's a relatively small percentage, but that's how we got our start, was at farmers markets. We used to do the Berkeley Farmers Market, too, and for a little while the Marin one. Now with the two stores, pretty much one farmers market is as much as we can keep up with. And it really gives us a chance to keep in touch with all the other local chefs, mm-hmm. you know, say hi, gossip, you know, pinch each other on the butt, and also, you know, to get good stuff to bring home to eat and also to use in the charcuterie.
Now, what year did you guys open?
We opened the store in 2008, the Napa one. Yeah, but we first started the business in 2003, just primarily doing farmers markets mm-hmm. and catering and whatever else to, you know, slowly grow the company, you know, buy equipment and all that fun stuff.
So it was 2008 or 9 or something like that, the tipping point where you went into full-fledged 80 different types of things every week, or
yeah,
were you really that from the beginning?
When we opened the store in Napa, I think that was definitely when we, you know, first of all, we went from like a one or two sale a week kind of thing to being open 7 days a week. You know, the amount of staff we had to hire and train quintupled, you know, and that enabled us to, you know, to make a lot more things too, because you got this 12-foot case that, you know, our philosophy on, like, you know, loading up a display case is the bottom should look like it's about to collapse, you know, so we really want a lot of products in there.
That's funny. The bottom is about to collapse. That's good advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Load it up, man.
Load it up.
Uh-huh.
So then you decide to write this book, and I know how much it took out of you guys, because if you see it, everybody, it is so intense, you know, the pictures, and they cover the spices and the brines. I mean, everybody should really read this book. It's a definitive guide. How did you decide to divide it, the index and the order of it, and compared to other charcuterie books before you? Like, how do you think, what was your philosophy there?
Well, we didn't want to focus on anything too narrow or specific, but we wanted it to kind of cover a good range of topics. So that's why it's got the butchery, the brine and smoked meats, fresh sausage, salumi, terrines, you know, and then all a lot of the stuff that goes with it too. Like, there's, you know, there's recipes in there for like leaf lard biscuits, for pickled mushrooms, you know, all the kinds of good stuff that goes along with it. It's not just pure, you know, butchery or pure sausage making. We wanted something, you know, that kind of represented the breadth of what we do at both of the stores. And, you know, we cover a lot of ground, but, you know, it's taken us a long time to get to this point. You know, it's not something that like one or two or three people, I mean, like we're three of 40, you know?
Right.
You know, it takes a lot of hard work and a lot of flexibility, you know, on everybody's part. So we wanted to really just kind of represent that in our first book.
Well, I want to bring, speaking about flexibility, there's no rules here. We just jump off tangents a lot.
with you?
So
get
talk
out.
About flexibility. Bailey, you're very flexible. Let's talk about that. I mean, 80 different things. I read the acknowledgments. They say you are the beating, pulsating heart of the fatted calf. So you're in charge, right, you know, with Toponia and Taylor. Tell me, I mean, 80 different things, flexibility, a team of 40 people. Give us a little lens into a week in the life from your perspective.
You have to be highly organized and talk to everybody all the time. Yeah, I came in from the bottom and kind of learned everything and then kind of worked my way up in the company. And in doing that, you learn how to make everything. You learn how everything works, and you learn how to kind of pass that information on to other people. And that's a part of my job that I really enjoy, is the training and showing people how to make this awesome product. And then to get to work with Taylor and Toponia all the time, they're two of my favorite people.
So when you say your detail or have to be organized, are you looking at temperatures and how long this has been?
In a given day, we have things organized by time, when we're going to grind stuff, when we're stuffing things, who's working on what table. Things have to be out at a certain time in terms of like our prepared foods, but in terms of like the production of the things that we make, on a given day, we'll be doing, you know, sausage in the morning, butchering in the afternoon, kind of the more, I don't want to call them like the tedious projects, but the projects that take a little bit longer, making rillettes, putting things into jars, things like that, labeling, packaging, and then down to like organizing the space that we have, the walk-in, the curing room, checking the temperatures, humidities in there, making sure everything is good to go.
What's your percentage of loss I mean, is there
5%? Zero.
Really? Well, no, I heard one guy forgot to lock the back of the truck, and some stuff fell
out. Yes, things... things
never
that was not a good
down.
Day.
things do happen, you know, but there's so many people that are on top of it that rarely do we have too many issues like that happen, and that was... A huge...
That was, I think, the biggest one ever. Yeah, that biggest. Was, like, right around Christmas, and we lost a huge amount of salami.
Yeah, it was, like, 300 pounds of salami on the Bay Bridge.
On the Bay Bridge.
Yeah. Just, out the back of the truck.
This awesome. We might as well, on a tangent, talk about this, the financial aspect of it. I know, Tabonia, you... Well, Tabonia, it's not easy. I mean, the charcuterie things are aging for a long time, so that adds an added challenge to the financing as all this stuff that's in storage. And then no one has really done any business like yours, so you didn't have that many models to compare yourself to. So talk about the financial aspects and how it's progressed, and also so that other listeners who might one day want to do what you do learn some tricks of the trade. Or
I think you can speak to this, but there's very little money in meat. For the farmer, for the producer, and cash flow is really difficult, especially, I mean, you have to really keep in mind that, you know, what you're buying today, you may not make a dollar on until, you know, February.
Right.
So it's really hard to kind of keep that sort of cash flow kind of going.
And yet you still do. How much would you stand to save if you bought commodity ingredients, like the lowest common denominator, cheapest chickens or pork?
I would be saving nothing because, you know.
No, I know. It wouldn't come out as good. But, I mean, you guys already are value added in the most expensive thing, and you're buying the most expensive ingredients. So it's like a trifecta of investment.
It makes it hard. And that's why we have to keep such a tight eye on everything. You know, not to, like... be like dictatorial and weird about the finances, but just making sure that everything is really well curated. You know, I mean, we're very well aware of the fact, you know, at every step of the process that, you know, this came from something that was grown for consumption, and some of them have heartbeats and some of them, you know, came out of the ground. So it's, and that, I think, at its core is really what charcuterie is all about, is like, you know, making sure that everything gets used, and turned into something that people really want to eat too.
So. Well, how can you make it that 80 things are good? You know, I mean, even in Italy, some guys might just make 10 things or 20. You really...
We do a lot of sampling, and we've done a lot of recipe development. And, you know, and also just, you know, having different, you know, like Bailey was talking about, like being highly organized. You know, we definitely break up our days so that, you know, people are cross-training to a degree. We want everybody to kind of have a good understanding about the way that everything works in both of our kitchens. Mm-hmm. But to that degree, there are still certain people who, like... Okay, if two or three lambs are coming in and they got to get broken down pretty fast, like, these are the people who are going to be, you know, on that. You know, mm-hmm. if we can pull somebody away from the sausage station or away from, you know, the ready-to-eat table, you know, to come over and work with them for a little bit on that, mm-hmm. Then that's, you know, that's always good, and we do our best to make that happen on a regular basis. But, you know, we do definitely have degrees of specialization, and also we're constantly sampling things. You know?
Did Cecchini in your time in Europe teach you most of this stuff, or did a book, or did a university? I mean, how did you...
I'd say
learned
most
of the 80.
I learned a lot of the basics in my time at Cafe Rouge with Marshall McBride in Berkeley.
Okay.
Yeah. I definitely saw what I really got from my time out of working with Dario Cecchini was first, just the amount of love and passion that he brings to his work is really inspiring. And also just different ways of cutting things, you know, because we have like a very standard method for the most part in the U.S. And, you know, just looking at different cuts differently, you know, and doing things like, you know, rib shoulder chops, you know, dusted with fennel and sea salt, and also the porchetta. That was the first place I learned how to make that,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, is awesome. It's like everywhere now. I mean, we're in Portland, Maine. We saw it on 3 restaurant menus.
Yeah,
like in, you know, it's really cool.
Well, very interesting. So, well, give a little shout out to the ingredient because you do invest a lot more than you would, is the answer. Commodity stuff is a lot less. Although, sometimes it's not. Like bellies, for instance, are more, but we always keep our prices the same. Just remember that. No, just kidding. But you do invest a lot more in ingredients, also from the local farms that you support. But I've visited some of these farms with you in the Midwest.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Just give a shout out to Larry and Paradise and what strikes you as so impressive about what they do and why you choose to support
them. Well, honestly, you know, we get asked a lot why we do buy a lot of California pork, but we do get asked a lot, like, why we don't buy strictly California pork. And honestly, it's because the processors, you know, the slaughterhouse that these pigs from that are grown in the Heritage Network that they go to is, I consider them, I kind of think of like us as on par with them. Like they are so focused in on the quality of everything that they do from start to finish, and it really shows. And unfortunately, we just don't have a facility like that in California. All the farms, they, you know, like I was talking about, they, you know, it's fresh air, good food, good water, plenty of space, you know, and it's personally just how we think animals should be raised. And so that's kind of the cornerstone of it. I think it's taken a lot longer for us to build a clientele because of the fact that, like, we're able to really expand all that much or to devote resources to other things because we're so focused on buying the best ingredients that we could.
Yeah.
But I think at this point people really understand, like, what we're all about, and most of them have tried it, and they, you know, I can only take so much credit for, like, the recipes and everything else. It's really, you know, being able to have access to really, really excellent. And that goes to, you know, garlic and spices and salt and good fresh herbs. I mean,
and you have chapters and all of that.
Yep.
Well, before we take a break, I want to come back and talk about community and Northern California, charcuterie in the U.S., kind of open it up a little bit. We have Scott and Katie in studio, old friends of yours.
Hello, boxes.
We'll bring them in. Before we go to break, tell us about the photography in this book, whoever is able to best talk about it, because it is very impressive, and there's, like, a lot of pictures of, like, people's hands and the motions you're supposed to make. I mean, there are a lot of photos in this book.
Yeah, so. We didn't want it all to be, like, just pretty, pretty food porn. I mean, there definitely is a lot of that, and he has a really great aesthetic. There is some nudity in there, for sure. What kind of cookbook would it be if it didn't? We've got some instructional procedurals. You know, we wanted to show people, like, how to you know, bone out a chicken, how to do basic cuts for a whole pig, you know, and pretty much everything in between. So Alex Farnham did the photography for our book. We met with, I think, 8 to 10 different photographers before deciding to work with him. And, you know, it was just his energy and just, you know, his aesthetic overall really, you know, kind of sealed the deal for us.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. Well, Joe, we will take a very short break. You're listening to The Main Course. I'm your host, Patrick Martins. And we will come back. And we have a few extra guests in the studio, so stay with us.
I've been living in California, and everything's just fine. But I get a funny, funny feeling each year about the same time.
It's when you are listening to Carolina Peach by the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Nothing they got out here, I really. Tastes the same. I'm talking about a sweet, 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 sweet Carolina peach.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Berries in July to make my taste buds sing. But on the Sunday of the summer, that August breeze just won't let
right,
me forget.
Exactly. Wow, that was one blueberry jam. So I'm very excited. We are Still the Main Course, Patrick Martin's. We're broadcasting live out of Roberta's Restaurant, which just came out with their cookbook. I think they're doing a book party at the end of the month, so we look forward to covering that on the network. Well, we have in studio with us Scott Boggs and Katie. Boggs? No.
Hello.
Yeah. Nice. Hey, so just tell people who you are, and then what does Fatted Calf do? No, wait. Who are you, and then what do you
do? He knows just about as well as anyone.
I
covered that.
What do I do?
Well, who are you?
Who am I? I am a chef in New York City, who used to be a farmer in California, which is how I know these guys.
And what do you do here? You work at the April Bloomfield, Ken Friedman Empire?
I do, for one more week. And then I'm doing a new project with Rose Bakery, which is based in Paris.
Wow.
So.
And are they opening a place here?
We are. We're opening the first New York bakery on 30th and Lexington in December.
That's interesting. Cross-pollination. I know Bouvette is a very famous restaurant. She's opening in Paris.
It's open. I ate there a couple weeks ago. Yeah.
Oh, is it lovely like the New York one is?
You know, it's funny. I've never eaten at the one in New York.
Oh. What was it?
But
lovely?
It was great. Yeah. It was absolutely wonderful. Yeah.
Is there anything in Paris that's not completely perfectly lovely? It's like every street, every building, everything. Although the food is not always great, right? I mean, you can eat bad food there.
You know, we ate five different dinners, and Bouvette was probably the best one. Well, there was one other one that was really good, but the other three weren't bad. But I feel like New York has a pretty amazing dining scene also.
Yeah, so. Yeah, for sure. So, well, people eat out more here because the home cooking might not be as good, whereas in places like Italy and France, where the home cooking is so good, you know, they're not as pushy to, you know, get into reservation wars and all that. But talking about opening it up a little bit, the tradition of charcuterie in the U.S., I mean, I throw this to anyone in the group, in what state is it at? I mean, obviously Europe, you can't go to a little hole-in-the-wall place without being able to get a little taste of some delicacy there, but in America, done the right way, they're few and far
personally
between.
I think that in Europe it kind of never really went away, but it's kind of experienced a little bit of a resurgence, whereas here I think in this country it's better than it's ever been. I mean, there are loads of new places popping up, and most of them really good at it, because, you know, just to even get the doors open and, you know, have a program takes a lot of focus and, you know, a lot of devotion to it.
But so, I mean, are there other guys like you producing 80 to 100?
Not the variety, but, you know, we're kind of old men on the corner at this point. You know, there all these, you know, there are a lot of, you know, 2 and 3 year old companies that are doing a lot of really cool things too. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, your event brought in a few of them. There was a guy from Spotted Trotter.
Yeah. That was the guy who had worked with us. When was Kevin there? Like 4 years ago?
4 years ago.
Yeah. He came and he worked with us for a little while. He was out doing a stage at another restaurant, and he decided to kind of abandon ship over there and come work with us. And he was there for 4 to 6 months or something like that. And then he did a lot of, a lot of his own recipe testing and development, and securing funds and a space and all that fun stuff and all the paperwork that goes with it. And but he's been open for like 2 years now.
Cleveland, Phoenix, Portland. I mean, are there people like you? I mean, are you part of like a constellation of charcutiers that are really trying to do it all in a way, all the traditions, all the meats?
Yeah, and you know, and everybody kind of brings their own sensibility to it too. You know, like I think we're a little bit more like, I guess, Northern California progressive with like mostly Italian and French roots. I mean, we do some Mexican, we do some Spanish, we do some Corsican, some German. Mm-hmm. But I'd say kind of at its heart, it's mostly French and Italian inspired.
So I've had so many guests who talk about the state of Northern California and what a fantastic terroir it is, but it's always through the perspective of cheese or fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. wine, things of that nature. So could you all, as farmers, as charcutiers, give us a state of the union on the Northern California meat industry for our listeners? Because no one knows about the ducks and the pigs and the cows and the geese. They know about chez Panisse and the perfect radish, so it'd be interesting to get your guys' perspective.
We kind of get a bad rep for the preciousness that implies sometimes. Mm-hmm. Well, Bailey, I mean, you do most of the sourcing. I mean, with who we work with, I mean, You know, there are lots of different great farms to work with, but
yeah, what's the community out there?
Tight. We have quite a few farmers that use really local up in Dixon, McCormick's, Petaluma, Jim Reichardt over at Sonoma County Poultry, River Dog Farms. We get our produce and chickens from them, and yeah, it's a really tight community. It's awesome to be able to kind of pick up the phone and just talk to the farmer and be like, hey, do you have a goat? Or I need some extra chickens, or running a special, or what's coming up. Like, in terms of produce, we can ask, you know, what's coming up in the season and you know, what's starting to come through. And then we'd model our menu based on what's available.
Is there more meat than there are customers, or more customers than there are meat? Is it competitive to get those goats or the best rabbits or whatever you guys buy for your work?
I think the rabbits are kind of competitive. It's hard to get rabbit in California. But no,
the way they fuck you would think there'd be more of them around.
Yeah, but they die really easily.
So. Yeah. They have their evolution has led them to have heart attacks and die when they think a predator is coming at them.
Oh,
you know, yeah. Well, it's like turkeys. You know, turkeys drown looking up at the rain.
Those are the inbred commodity ones, not ours.
No, those are some smart turkeys out of Frank's place, for sure.
And then, are they delicacies? I mean, I know you have one guy doing ducks, one guy doing goats. I mean, are these the best in the country? I mean, these guys are... There's just a rich culture for supporting the best out there.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of them... We don't really go scour the ends of the earth for protein, especially. I mean, you know, we started buying pork from you because you were stalking me like a madman, and I just had to try it. And
literally.
So, and
it was a restraining order from like 2005.
But you know,
the
samples that you sent out, I mean, we've been working with you since what, 04, 05?
Yeah,
it's, I mean, very close to when we started. And we go way back, and we're definitely symbiotically attached at the hip, but
yeah.
Yeah, so we don't really go scouring much for Iowa beef or, lamb from North Carolina or whatever. I mean, a lot of them, their relationships that carried over from back when I was at Cafe Rouge. Like, I mean, we've been buying, the guy we buy ducks from, I've been working with him for about 15 years now, and
wow.
I'm still one of his newest customers. Like, he's got, people who were, at Stars back in the day, and, people like Nancy Oaks,
right.
I've been buying from him for 30 years.
Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you guys going to go national? I know there's been talk of a mail order company and all that. What is the state of that?
The big issue there is space and supply. We're definitely, we'd be cleared to do it, and it's something we'd like to do one day, but if we can't do it well, and if it's just going to be problematics and get in the way of the existing programs that we have, then we're gonna hold off until we can make it happen and do it right.
Right,
this is pretty much the state of that.
Because it is interesting, Scott. Right, I mean, most people and Americans have not gotten a chance to taste fatted calf and all the diversity. I mean, what do you think? Where do you think they stand in the world of charcuterie and
guys?
Yeah, what do you?
I mean, I think they're amazing. When I, when I started farming in California, I just showed up in the shop one day and said, hey, do you guys want to buy some chickens? hey guys. Well, we were doing pigs and chickens and guinea hens mostly. And, luckily, Bailey was talking about, they call up the farmer and say, hey, can we get this from you? But these guys, for the farmers, it's the farmer calls them up and says, hey, can you take 20 extra chickens this week? And they were like, absolutely.
Oh, they just agreed to weave it into their existing system.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, what's amazing about what they do is that they're flexible, and they make it work to help out everybody else, which is great for the farmers.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you're not working with a commodity product, you're going to be subject to availability and stuff happens. I mean, one of our other turkey suppliers we're going to get from this year, they just didn't get a crop because coyotes ate them all.
Right. We had nothing to do with that.
He sent in some coyote drones.
The fact that I was arrested with a van full of coyotes, there was no connection. I always drive around with those.
How do you train them to ride in the car with you?
Yeah, it's amazing. This isn't my real neck. But no, it is very interesting. I mean, do you have a lot more competition now than you did a decade ago?
We don't even consider.
I know you don't.
Well, no, I mean, and it's not just because I'm being like generous of spirit. I mean,
there's no one else doing it.
We have been doing it for long enough. We're very secure with with what we make and how we're perceived through lots of hard work. A decade of building that. And so, no, we wouldn't be threatened by the fact that somebody opened another meat market in San Francisco. I mean, for one thing, that's ridiculous.
What percentage of your sales is the market versus farmer's market versus wholesale? I mean, ballpark.
I'd say farmer's market would be like 10%, And, okay. I mean, we don't have a wholesale program.
I see.
And we, we sell... I mean, the two stores, they vary. I mean, especially if you wanted to break it down. Like, we sell different things at our San Francisco store than we do in Napa.
Is there a difference in what the locals eat there? I mean, San Franciscans, that's interesting. What is that difference?
People in Napa tend to be a little bit less adventurous, but sometimes, we'll be surprised. There's a whole lot more foot traffic, like just coming through the neighborhood on a regular basis in San Francisco. But that's definitely picking up a lot more too.
What is the state of the market in Napa? I know when Copia, the Institute of Wine and Food, that museum was open, and then they opened.
First 3 years were hard, man.
What was it called? The space itself,
Copia, the Oxbow Market,
Oxbow Public Market.
So it was supposed to be a big renaissance, much like the Ferry Plaza was. It didn't work out.
Well, it opened the week that the economy just tanked back in 2008.
So what's the state of it now?
It's booming.
Really?
It's going really well. We're definitely a lot busier. The inside of the market, you go in there, it's always packed. Whereas for a while, there's a lot of tenant turnover. They're trying to figure out the mix. Horrible weather for the first 2 months it was open. One of the streets that is adjacent to it was closed for a good part of it. That was awesome. It was one of those things that you look back on, you're like, well, that made me tougher, and now I can handle pretty much anything. But like at the time, it was terrifying. So
what are your three top sellers? If you could be so reductive and just...
Mortadella,
bacon, Spanish chorizo.
Yeah, those three things for sure.
How many pounds of that? You're producing those every week, I bet.
We do, and we make them in small batches. The mortadella we do in 40 to 60 pound batches, and we do about two of those a week. Spanish chorizo, currently we're at maybe about 150 pounds a week to 200, depending on selling.
To a home cook sounds like a lot, but considering that like even someplace like a local Whole Foods, I mean, they'll go through like 400 pounds of ground beef just in one day.
Yeah, sure.
So, it's definitely on the scale of things, definitely still small scale for sure.
And what is the state of your HACCP plans? I mean, are there things that you are not...
Oh, man, why you gotta go there? You bring up paperwork
are you prohibited from doing certain things that would make it taste closer to the Italian, or no? Is it basically the same opportunity?
Well, we can't really leave our meat out overnight on the counter, as I saw in Spain when we were traveling through there.
To be fair, Americans do that stuff too, but they're just not supposed to.
We are regulated by the CDFA, the state in California. They send an inspector in every other week, and he looks at our paperwork.
It must be his worst nightmare. 80 different products. I mean, he must hate coming over.
I think justifies his job.
Oh, really?
He comes upstairs, hangs out for 2 hours.
But you don't need a USDA guy in your facility full time.
No.
Well, we're not USDA currently. We're kind of starting that process.
Only ship within state lines, right? So you don't need...
Well, we're not shipping
at
all.
Ship anything,
we're just selling through our retail outlets.
Got it. Very interesting. So you do have seem to have a good policy with those people, because here in New York, there are a lot of famous stories of where certain things just couldn't get done because of a rule or regulation.
Yeah, and there are certain things that I guess, I mean, there's nothing that we have wanted to make and asked and them saying, no, you can't make that. Like, a lot of it, I mean, we started so small and we're so under everyone's radar. For a long time, we're inspected by the county, like the smallest level of, health inspections. And they would come around and they'd make sure that, our surfaces were clean and that our temperatures were good and this, that, and the other thing. But we didn't, at a certain point, the state started inspecting us. And that's where, like... the paperwork and the HACCP plans and, all that mind-numbing stuff starts coming through.
But I think that's what holds back a lot of other companies that are small and new is all of those steps that it takes to get...
Before you even open.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, but you guys just did it. You plowed through it.
Does most of it. Yeah. And our production team fills out some forms in the morning and, does time and temp logs and things like that,
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, to kind of get back to the technical, we have about 5 minutes left. I wanted just to ask you about the different kinds of fats that you use.
That's
for
a more fun topic. Yeah.
No, I mean,
no, it is.
I'm just I mean, definitely it's important paperwork. That we cover the important issues for the charcutiers listening or whoever going to log
Don't be distracted by a HACCP plan. You know, if you want to make charcuterie, then
With that. Yeah. You got to weed them out. It's like law school. 60% of the people drop out. Fats of different kinds. Take us through that.
You want to take poultry fats? I'll talk about pork fat.
Sure.
All right.
You have duck fat, chicken fat.
We used to have foie fat.
Yeah, foie. Yeah, that foie. That was great for the ban in foie in California. We would make the terrines, and then out of that, you would wind up with this super, super rich, delicious foie gras fat that you can like fry your potatoes in for lunch, and it's tasty.
Yeah, good stuff.
And and you would use that to mix with other.
So
meats?
One of our most popular things that we do with the duck fat is the duck rillette that we make. We basically just cook the legs in their own fat, really low temperature for a long time, shred it, and we incorporate some brandy, thyme, and four spice into it, and jar it, sell it. It's really creamy and tasty.
Mm. Yeah, it's also like one of the best natural like sealants and preservatives there is. You know, it's like what people have been using for centuries to seal up the rillette or the pâté they made, and put down in their root cellar to get them through the winter, while huddling by the fire,
Waiting for it to be ready. Yeah. Tell us about pork fats and how they're used.
A lot of similar uses, confits, terrines, things like that. We use them for garnishes, diced back fat for certain things like our salame toscano and the mortadella. That one's huge, too. But it's it plays pretty integral role in charcuterie and cooking in general. Fats, it's what kind of lubes everything up and keeps it going.
Is that why you buy 350 pounds of trim a week from us?
No, we buy just straight back fat and leaf lard. We just use that to render out. Yeah,
got it.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted to ask about the different. Tell us about stock. And lardo and all these fat, those are just fats that stay fat the whole way through the cycle and nothing gets added to them, right?
Well, the lardo, I mean, you add spices to it. It's back fat that's then cured, and then we put into a vacuum bag for a few months, and it cures, slice it really thin. Stock is the bones with water added. Aromatics, so that's not necessarily like a fat, but it actually does generate a nice skim on the top.
What are the byproducts of charcuterie making?
What are the byproducts?
Yeah, like things you have to throw away or something that results from some process.
Mostly just like pan drippings from roasts and things like that.
Everything gets used.
Pretty much, yeah. Like for a terrine or something, we'll pack it into a terrine mold and cook it really slowly in the oven and then, chill it down and turn it out the next day. Portion it into pieces and out it goes, Yeah, the idea is to not, have really any.
I feel like the charcuterie is an outlet for your leftovers from the rest of the animal. You're cutting your chops and making ham and then you have all this trim and then that's what we've always done is we turn that into charcuterie.
Mm-hmm. Or you take your fancy cuts like whole loins and cure those too. It's just like that's the
Now, how important is the vessel? Like the molds and all of that. I mean, do you have your favorite molds, or can you just buy them off the store? Do they develop their own characteristics over time to kind of shape everything?
You mean like the salami molds? Well, that's definitely those are very specific to our facility because we've never used like a commercial starter culture or a mold or anything like that. Like an inoculation. In San Francisco and Napa both have their own distinct, ambient penicillin. It's kind of like, for San Francisco sourdough starter. That's because, of its placement in the country and where it is in relation to the bay and all that fun stuff. In Napa, you have a huge winemaking industry, so there's a lot of good stuff floating around the air. And that's, that's that whitish mold you see on the outside of real salami that, keeps the bad stuff out, the good stuff in, and which, definitely contributes to, its overall kind of flavor profile, I guess.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, it is a great book. I mean, it's really like a... But, it's a boring book, and I mean that in a good way, I mean, it's exhaustive. It's all you need for if you're serious.
Well, you don't want to sit down and, read... most cookbooks from start to finish just in one go. It's not, you know, it's not a novel.
But you'd be a dummy not to read this one cover to cover if you were planning on becoming a charcutier or just wanted to learn all about
it. We want it to be a good resource for, you know, professionals and also, you know, enthusiastic amateurs as well. So, you know, we hope that, you know, basically our goal was to provide a bit of insight, you know, advice from things we've learned for anyone who's interested in making their meat cookery better. You know, and if you want to tackle a project like salami, that info's in there. But if you really just want to make a kick-ass like roast chicken with nettle butter, that's pretty straightforward. You know, pretty much anyone can handle that. So
yeah and it has a chapter on spices and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, and very pickles, very interesting book. Yeah,
bean dishes.
Well, it's $40, and it's published by 10 Speed Press. Some very interesting people, important people, have done quotes for the back of the book. April Bloomfield.
Oh, and a Patrick Martin.
Tracy Desjardins. Matt Jennings. Mark Vetri.
Yeah.
Who I like very much. Mm-hmm. He actually helped me for graduate school. I didn't write a very good thesis. So it was on medieval feasts. So I decided to throw a medieval feast to show that I had learned something through action from my professor and 12 of her friends. I had 12 of my friends from the class, and it was a big party. I had like 14 courses, and I was screwed. Everyone was like an hour or two away, and Mark Vetri, of all people, heard about it and came over to the house and pulled together all of them. Just a little bit of salt.
Was it enough to get you your degree?
Just a stock, yes. Uh-huh.
Cool.
I got a D minus, thanks to him. It would have been an F.
Pulling you out the depths.
Would have been an F. But anyway, it is an honor to have you guys. I really do think everybody needs to make it a point to stop. It's like a cultural landmark in this country to visit the Fat of Calf when you're in Northern California.
Sweet of you.
Thank you.
And
but don't tag it like Patrick did.
Don't tag it with HRN logos. I did that for you, Joe. Anyway, well, thanks for listening. We have a very exciting group of shows. We have What Doesn't Kill You. Then we have the Arts and Seizures show.
Nice.
Arts and Seizures. And then we have The Morning After and then Snacky Tunes. So, and I believe, by the way, for Arts and Seizures that Mike is bringing in his theremin,
which
is a very cool instrument that has added great comic effect to everything he says. Well, thanks, Scott, Toponia, Taylor, Bailey,
thanks, Patrick.
Katie, plus one, about to be plus one. And thanks for listening. And stay tuned on Tuesday for the premiere of the new Heritage Radio Network site. Thanks for listening.
Congratulations, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.